Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Hello, I am Kimberly Adams. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kyle Risdahl. It is Tuesday. That means one podcast, one topic. We are talking capitalism and climate change today. And here's the dilemma. Capitalism arguably got us where we are on a changing climate. Question, of course, is can capitalism get us out of where we are?
One person who certainly thinks so is Xiling Su. He's an economist and D'Alembert professor at Florida State University College of Law and author of the new book, Capitalism and the Environment, A Proposal to Save the Planet. Dr. Su, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's get to the topic of your book. What parts of capitalism do you believe can help save the planet? Because, you know, well, let me back up for a minute. Do you buy the thesis that capitalism got us where we are in changing climate?
I don't. I don't think capitalism is to blame. I don't think you could blame capitalism for climate change any more than you could blame capitalism for, say, firearm manufacturers marketing toxic masculinity to kids. Capitalism only goes in a direction that political choices steer it. And we've just made a couple of bad political choices that have caused polluting industries to overpollute.
What are those choices?
Well, you know, you think about the economy as this machine. If you told the economy, let's maximize GDP and let's not worry about the environmental harm that's caused thereby. Guess what? A capitalist economy is going to do that, and it's going to do it very efficiently. So the choices would be, let's focus on economic growth and let's not think too much about the environmental costs of that economic growth. I will say that even if capitalism isn't strictly to blame for it, what it does do, because it's so efficient, is amplify the effects of those political choices. And, you know, it's done a marvelous job of growing the economy and ignoring environmental harm.
All right. So how does capitalism get us out of this then? Because, well, I'm not going to go off my standard spiel about political choices in this country just simply not being made. But how does capitalism help us?
You know, the thing about capitalism is that if it's operating well under a well-functioning democracy, there are some pretty surprising things that happen in capitalist societies. What we've been doing, in my view, wrong for the past 150 years is not pricing environmental harm. What I'm proposing in the book is that we should have environmental taxes that reflect the cost of environmental harm, of whatever industrial activity or commercial activity is going on. Now, what that does is if you actually make capitalists, industrialists, everybody really, kind of take into account the environmental harm that they're causing to everybody else, they make different choices. What we've been doing for the past 150 years is making choices while ignoring the environmental costs. If you make people think about the environmental costs, in the interest of trying to reduce their tax bill, they try and figure out ways to reduce their environmental harm. And the fact that we haven't been doing that makes it seem like this is a big lift, but really, it's just capitalism while making people think about a different set of prices. It's a big deal that we haven't had environmental prices all this time because, you know, if you tell people, like, you got to pay for labor, land, energy, raw materials, but you don't have to pay for environmental harm, guess what? They're going to do a great job of economizing on land, labor, energy, and raw materials, but not environmental harm.
You prefaced that last answer with, if capitalism operates in a well-functioning democracy. Given where we are at the moment, how can we actually deploy these strategies of capitalism to solve environmental harms if we may not necessarily be in a well-functioning democracy?
Well, I don't think I can solve the well-functioning democracy part in the book. What I can say is, you know, because of that West Virginia decision, you know, a carbon tax came close to being part of a reconciliation package. I don't know, maybe now that West Virginia has been decided, that it might seem a little bit more important of an option this time around, this next time around. You know, the other thing I would say is that, you know, it's true. One tax would be tough enough in Congress. What about, like, several of them, which is what I propose? Well, you know, here's my pitch. Probably over 100,000 Americans and millions worldwide die of air pollution, and having nothing to do with climate change, by the way. I'm talking about fine particulate matter. You know, why do we think that's okay? Would you pay the equivalent of a few cents more per gallon of gas, depending on where you live, maybe, I don't know, $5 a month extra on your monthly electricity bill, if doing so, if everybody doing so would save $100,000 lives? You know, that's the kind of that's the magnitude of costs and lives we're talking about, and I think that doesn't get talked about enough.
So, sorry, Kimberly. So the answer to that question obviously is yes, right? Of course I would pay an extra $5 a month. There are some in this economy who can't, but many, many, many people can. The question is that we collectively lack a sense of urgency and have since climate change first got into the dictionary. And I wonder how you try to impart that now when, and you can't see me because this is a podcast, but I'm gesturing wildly at everything. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, maybe the way to pitch this also is to talk about how you could make money in an environmentally capitalist society. You know, it's kind of funny. I lived in Canada, in Vancouver, Canada, for about 8 years. And while I was living there, the province instituted a provincial carbon tax. Now, I wrote about carbon taxes. I thought I knew what I was talking about. At that time, right when it was getting started, we had our second child and we had to add rooms onto our house. So we hired a contractor and his name is Dave, a real hard hat and lunch bucket kind of guy. But you know, while we're going over the blueprints, he says, you know what, as long as we're ripping the roof off and adding a few rooms upstairs, this is what you should do. You should install a high-efficiency furnace and weatherize all of your windows, even the ones that we're not putting in up top, because, you know, Professor Sue, this is carbon tax coming on in the province, and the payback period just went from 8 years to 3 years. And I said, well, yeah, I knew about the carbon tax, but what moved you to be so interested in how much money you could save me? And he said, you know, you're like the 10th project I'm working on, and five of those people have been asking me, can I save money because of the carbon tax? Can I? Is this the time to get a high-efficiency furnace? And I tell that story because sometimes you just don't really know how a price signal works until it actually happens. I never would have guessed that my contractor would be so on top of the effects of a carbon tax on home renovations until it actually happened. I think if you kind of talk about how environmental capitalism is just like the capitalism we've always been experienced, only with a different orientation, then maybe it seems more palatable. It's not going to sound palatable to the people that are going to lose their jobs. Like, you know, we can't really afford to pay people to dig coal out of the ground anymore. It's not going to sound palatable to them, but to a lot of other people, I think it'll sound pretty familiar.
There are going to be people who hear this and think, look, we have tried capitalism as a solution to many ills of society, including climate change, and look where it has gotten us. Isn't it time to try something new? Like, is there an argument that there are other systems or other strategies that are better than capitalism for solving problems at the scale of the global climate crisis?
Well, two things. I think some people think socialism might be an alternative. Socialism doesn't have a great track record on the environment. Now, as for, we tried this before, I don't think we actually have tried this. I don't think we've actually had an economy where we did a lot of pricing environmental harm. So, you know, one country that has done a pretty good job of pricing carbon anyway is Sweden. And they're thriving. They have a healthy economy. They make lots of stuff that the rest of the world wants to buy, and they're doing it without a big carbon footprint. So, you know, we haven't really tried this, at least not to the scale that I'm suggesting we need to try it.
So for the layperson reading this book, what do you want them to take away?
What I want people to take away is that, you know, capitalism is an engine, and it's a pretty powerful one. You point it in one direction, and it's going to go. What I think we could do is point it in a different direction. We could point it in a direction in which people not only take account of environmental effects, but they try and figure out ways, because they have a profit incentive, to reduce those environmental effects. And the way to do that, it doesn't sound like fun to have kind of taxes. Who's in favor of a tax? But what I'd like them to remember is that the costs of those taxes aren't going to be terribly big. They're going to be big enough for a lot of people to change some decisions, but on a day-to-day basis, it's not going to be as costly as some people would have them believe.
Xiling Su is an economist, also D'Alembert professor at Florida State University, the College of Law there. And more to the point, he's got a new book coming out. It's called Capitalism and the Environment, A Proposal to Save the Planet. Professor, thanks for your time, sir. We do appreciate it.
Thanks so much having me.
Saving the planet. There you go.
I got really stuck when he said that if you told people they'd have to pay $5 more in, you know, their monthly electric bill or a couple cents more per gallon of gas to save 100,000 lives. This is almost exactly the argument that we made earlier in the pandemic, we being media, government officials, everyone saying, put on a mask, stay at home, deal with these economic inconveniences to save hundreds of thousands of lives. And it didn't work.
Right.
And also, I'm mindful of the disproportionate impact on various communities of the consequences of climate change. It falls predominantly on the developing world. Here in the United States, predominantly on low-income BIPOC communities. And I really do question whether sympathy and empathy are enough.
Yeah, they're not, right? I mean, they're not.
I was ready for your counterpoint. No, I really was.
No counterpoint at all. You're spot on. You're spot on.
So, I mean, I guess the economic incentives are all that's left, huh?
Yeah. I guess we'll see. Don't know.
All right, let us know what you think. Our number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UBSMART. You can also send us a voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
News, 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 news. Kimberly Adams, you go first.
Still talking about the Supreme Court. So there was yet another kind of earth-shattering bit of news out of the court just, you know, at the end of their session that they're going to be taking up a case from North Carolina about whether state legislatures should be immune from judicial oversight in state court when it comes to setting election rules, right? So this is, it sounds super wonky, but long story short, it could potentially set up a situation where state courts and state legislatures throw out election results and cause all sorts of shenanigans. Potentially, this is what the people who are the most worried about it say. But the larger thing that seems to be happening with the court and why it sort of has a lot of implications in my head for sort of business and technology and everything, is that they are just going hardcore into individual states need to be deciding things as opposed to the federal government. And that in some ways just really exacerbates the differences that people are going to feel within individual states in terms of their day-to-day lives. And we've been looking a lot at this over on the Tech Show in terms of state-by-state privacy rules, which are starting to become more and more relevant as a lot of people are more worried about their health data and online privacy in light of the other Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe versus Wade. But where you live moving forward is really starting to have an increasing impact on what your social and political and economic life is going to look like. And that's always been true to some extent, but I feel like it's getting even more so.
Yeah, I the evidence only backs you up. I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. Okay, so a quick one from me, sort of along the lines of what we were talking about with Professor Sue. Capitalism and the climate and what's going on. There's a great piece in Bloomberg today about natural gas and how It is now the linchpin of global energy markets and in some way globalization itself, because everybody's shifting to natural gas, or wants to, because it is less polluting than oil. It's not zero pollution, obviously, but it's less polluting than oil. And the prices are going up and not everybody can afford it. And there's tensions in Europe between the Europeans and the Russians about natural gas. And the Norwegian natural gas workers are on strike. So prices going up there. It's a really interesting, not even at all wonky piece, which is unusual for Bloomberg. And we'll put it on the show page. It's just, it's really interesting. I don't know.
Did you hear about that massive chemicals plant in Germany where they said that because of natural gas shortages, it could just like extremely minimize operations? And I know it sounds obscure, a chemical company, but these are the chemicals that go into lots and lots of products.
Yeah.
And, you know, yet another interesting bit of the supply chain that could get snagged up.
Is definitely going to... You know, I think that's the handwriting's on the wall. Anyway, that's it for the news. Let's do the mailbag, shall we?
Hi, Kai and Kimberly.
This is Godfrey from San Francisco.
Jesse from Charleston, South Carolina.
And I have a follow-up question.
It has me thinking and feeling a lot of things.
Okay, so I talked about the cover of last week's New Yorker on the pod, and it was basically two Americas, but... two Americas living side by side, right? One side had Black Lives Matter. One side had the thin blue line American flag, right? So it was two different Americas, but living side by side. And Kimberly said, would we actually really see people living side by side in this country today? Because that's increasingly not what we're seeing. And we got this.
Hi, this is Reed. I'm calling from Media, Pennsylvania. I was listening to your show from Monday, and I live in one of those places where the two halves of the New Yorker cover live side by side.
Wow.
I live on a street that's about a mile long. It's a circle. And I'd say we are evenly divided. And at very interesting times of the year, the sign competition gets passive aggressively heated.
Wow.
I think there are a lot of swing states where everyone walks into a barbecue and is a little bit concerned about what's going to happen. But we get on to get along. Thanks for making me smart. Elections are always interesting in Pennsylvania. And I look forward to hearing your coverage in the next few months.
Wow.
That's super interesting.
That is super interesting. That was a great voicemail. That's really interesting. Wow. Huh.
A topic for another discussion that I often ask people is, what have we done to our country that we have made it bad manners to talk about politics with each other?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But that's a conversation.
That's actually a really good question. What the hell happened that became something we can't even talk about?
And what's the consequence of it, given that it's literally bad manners to talk about politics?
Right.
All right. After last week's answer to the Make Me Smart question about the double space after a period, we got so many emails and voicemails and DMs and mentions and everything, including this voicemail.
This is Elaine Farrer from Pasadena, California. And we listen to you guys every night. It's really great.
Thank you.
And tonight we heard this thing about two spaces after a period. We don't do that because the character counts in our scientific abstract won't allow us an extra dispensation for that extra space.
Oh, my God. It's like Twitter.
So we don't do two spaces after a period so that we can save characters and write more letters. Thank you for making me smart.
That's pretty funny.
That's a good point. Those extra spaces would add up pretty quickly on a character count.
Yeah. All right. Go ahead.
I just love how everyone's reaction to this is extremely personal.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No one cares about grammar at all. It's just like, this is how I feel. It's like the Oxford comma level commitment.
Oh, my God. We should do a show on the Oxford comma. Anyway, we got another one. Here we go.
Hi, this is Curtis in Boise. I just wanted to point out that when I'm texting and I double space after a word, it automatically inserts a period. On another note, I have a suggestion to help us all understand the mood of the country. When I listen to the podcast, every time the news is anything but good, Kai will sigh a lot. I think we should count how many sighs he gives us per episode. And then on Marketplace, when he's doing the numbers, he can give us the count from the previous day.
Oh, my God.
We could call it the Kai Psi Index.
Kill me now. Just kill me now, Curtis. Oh, my Lord. Oh, my Lordy B. We're going to go. But first, the answer to the Make Me Smart question, something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about. Here you go.
Hi, this is Pete in Southern California. One thing that I didn't know or really appreciate at all before the pandemic and afterwards was how many kids really relied on school to provide food. I was so shocked and just completely caught unaware by the fact that there are so many people that relied on food through either lunch or breakfast. I'm really disappointed in myself. I didn't realize how much kind of food insecurity there was and how it was tied to the public school system.
Absolutely no reason to be disappointed in yourself, because not a lot of people are aware of how deeply food insecurity is tied into the public school system. But yeah, it's a big, big deal. I'm glad you brought that up, Pete. Yeah.
And they expanded who could access food from schools during the pandemic, and a lot of schools organized to let kids take, you know, drop-offs where parents could come by and pick up meals and food and snacks, and those ended up getting shared amongst whole families. Mm-hmm. And I think there are efforts to try to extend that program, which expired, but I'll look that up and get back to folks.
Yeah, they're working on expanding it, but it did expire, and for now, only a couple of states have said we're going to keep doing it. California is one of them. I don't know who the others are, but yeah, it's school lunches are not just school lunches is the name of that game. Anyway, do us a favor. Keep sending us your answers via voice memo to our email at makemesmart@marketplace.org or leave us a message 508-827-6278. 508-UBSMART is what that spells. Oh, my gosh.
Are you around your dogs?
I'm not. No, I'm in the studio, actually. I'm in the studio.
Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Our intern is Olivia Zhao. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter.
Juan Carlos Toronto engineered the program today. Charlton Thorpe's going to mix it down later. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. The senior producer is Bridget Bodner, but she's off this week, so I don't know who's producing this podcast. No, I'm kidding. Marissa. I know. Donna Tam is director of On Demand. Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough. I suppose Bridget's going to go back and listen. She probably will.
Probably. I love the passion of the people around this double space after period thing.
I will die on this hill, man. We talked about it last week.
It's a nice low stakes thing
about. That's right. Oh, my goodness.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.